You are listening to the Hostage to the Devil podcast. Some listeners may find this content disturbing.
One of the books we have in our house is Windswept House, and that is a novel of some notoriety because it talks about archbishops, cardinals doing satanic rituals in the Vatican. And Martin is saying, he's quoted as saying, 95% of events in this book are real, and 85% of the characters are real people. Do you personally think he's being metaphorical with the satanic ritual in the Vatican, or do you believe him?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously I would have to be in a different position in life than I am to know for sure. But there's always been Satanism in Rome, always. Of course, there's Satanism everywhere. We ourselves are kind of satanic whenever we sin. But in terms of worshiping the dark angel, that has always existed in Rome.
In the end, Father Martin would write an astonishing 16 books, most famously his work Windswept House, which has become important in the light of the crisis in the church.
Malachi Martin wrote this book called Windswept House, and you know it's called a Vatican novel, but if you go and read the interviews or listen to the coast-to-coast interviews that Martin gave at the time that he wrote the book, he called it faction. In other words, it's fiction based on facts. It's not the kind of area that I want to spend a lot of time researching because I just feel dirty when I do it. You know, I'd rather dig into biblical studies and things like that. But
just with everything else going on, I felt it was important to bring this out one more time and to trot out Father Martin's work, which as a relatively recent Catholic going, and I'm in my 10th year as a Catholic, and I've been fascinated by Father Martin's writings, and I feel like he had something to say.
Well, you've asked for it, and here it is, the show on Malachi Martin.
I thought it's
in the first couple chapters, there's this satanic ritual of enthroning of Satan in the Vatican, and at the same time, there's one done in, I think it's Charleston, South Carolina. And so everybody, including myself, is picking up a copy of Malachi Martin's Windswept House. It's actually pretty well written. There's parts of it that get tedious. Whenever he's talking about politicians, I get bored. When he's talking about churchmen, I get interested. It kind of goes back and forth. I would say read it, but don't go mentioning it as gospel.
Now let's move to your latest publication, Windswept House, a Vatican novel.
Yes.
What prompted you to write this?
The fact that there is a plan implemented for the last 5 or 6 years by cardinals and bishops, cardinals very near the Pope and cardinals throughout the world in America as well as abroad, and bishops, to have this Pope to resign on his 75th birthday. You see, every bishop, and the Pope is a bishop, should resign at the age of 75. The Pope is an exception normally. But these people want him to resign because they don't consider that he is forward-looking enough, or vigorous enough, or liberal enough. And they actually happen to agree with those who think that the human population must be severely limited by artificial means, and they're willing to compromise on the whole question of married priests. They don't mind the idea of married priests. And some of them would like to see women ordained as priests, all of which this Pope will not allow.
Now, one of the things that I noted in the Windswept House is that the prologue is history, the beginning of the book,
yes,
is most unsettling.
Yes, it is.
And if any of those things are true, and sometimes they say that the truth can only be told as fiction,
yes,
and there are some names in this book that have a either hauntingly frightening similarity to known characters.
Well, let me deal with that, Michael, very forthrightly.
Okay.
Our own favorite American, Norman Mailer, following Taylor Caldwell, that marvelous writer Taylor Caldwell, they invented or they gave usage to a form called faction. By that they mean real facts dressed up as fiction. So, in other words, I want to describe. Supposing I was Taylor Caldwell, I want to describe the oil barons and the Kennedys in particular and the Buckleys. Then I would give them all pseudonyms and create a fictional novel about the reality that happened. Similarly with Windswept House, I wanted to write about this plan to get the Pope to resign and the type of church that those who are urging him to resign would like to have. I clothed their names in fiction, gave them fictional names. 95% of the fictional names cover real people, real cardinals, real bishops.
Of course, and I'm sure this is going to disturb some people.
Well, yes and no, provided that the real name isn't down, they feel they get away with it. But I thought we should put down, and then of the facts, or something else, the facts are, trace the history of John Paul II as Pope since about 1990, roughly. But it's meant to outline this plan. It's also meant to remind Roman Catholics and non-Catholics that John Paul II has left the greater questions in suspended. He doesn't solve them at all.
Right.
And the book ends on a note of suspense, as you probably have found out.
Oh, yes, it's quite
so
suspenseful.
That's why I wrote the book, wrote Winthrop's House. It does emphasize, though, the desirability on the part of many, the desirability of the Church to be a useful socio-cultural and socio-political stabilizing factor throughout the New World Order.
But I don't know how that's going to be accomplished necessarily because there's so much anti-Church sentiment or Christian...
Well, but the proponents of this say if the Church makes that compromise about abortion, contraception, mm-hmm. marriage, divorce, then we can all settle down.
Well, yeah.
Of course, the Church will not do that, except certain leaders would like to do that.
Right. Hi, Robert. It's been a while.
Salutations.
Yes. Thanks for coming on the show
again.
It's
been a while, Mark.
Today we're talking about Winthrop House. I believe it was the first book I read, and Keys of This Blood. So, yeah, I'd love to talk about, Winthrop House, the controversial book, how you told me that he wrote it in a factional style. So first and foremost, let's get a little update from yourself since the last time we spoke. What's been going on? You're wearing an eye patch like Jack Sparrow, so please tell me what's going on, please.
I've got glaucoma in my right eye, and it's a kind of blindness where the optic nerve that goes into the brain, the optic nerve is like 95% destroyed because of the glaucoma. And the blindness is, it's not the kind of blindness where if you were to walk into a windowless room, turn out the lights and shut the door, it's not black. It's more like these amorphous colored lights that just move and shift. And it doesn't form a coherent picture with my eye. The reason why I occasionally wear a patch is that my good eye, obviously the nerve tries to reconcile the input from the good optic nerve with the damaged, very damaged optic nerve to form a picture for my brain to process and see. And it just leads to, the occasionally very severe migraine headaches. And then I have to take a medicine that I refer to as Goofenthal because it makes me pretty loopy. So I just, sometimes just prefer the eye patch instead.
Loopy more than usual.
Well, I don't know. My wife would be a better judge than I would. But
right, let's get stuck into Winthrop House then because,
sure.
Like I said before, it was... I think it was the first book that I read when I started to tackle the subject of Malachy Martin 7-8 years ago now. So talk me through, for any audiences that don't really know the book, and give us sort of a run through, like a synopsis of this book and why it was controversial. And then we can talk more about your own sort of depiction and interpretation of it.
Sure. The book Winthrop House that came out, I believe, in 1996, as far as being a story, pretty much picked up where his novel Vatican left off with the election of the Polish Pope. So it picked up there thematically, but it began with references to the late 1950s when Pope Pius XII received in audience members of the newly formed Council of Europe, which was the
I guess, the predecessor to the European Economic Community or the European Union, EU. And he gave them a warning. He said, Europe will have its day, but unless you acknowledge and adhere to the Christian, historical Christian roots of Europe, your experiment will be a failure. And then it leaps to 1963, June 29th or 30th, with the Satanic enthronement ceremony in the Chapel of Saints Peter and Paul at the Vatican. A lot of people think that it is actually inside the Basilica of Saint Peter, and that's not quite accurate. It's in the Vatican, but it's not in the big basilica itself. But there was a, no, it's, as Malachy was wont to say, it was a factional book. He told facts with a story, changing the names so that he would keep his kneecaps. That was his standard phrase. I don't want to lose my kneecaps.
And who was he afraid? Who was he afraid of at that time then?
The group of, I believe it would have been the group of clerics, senior level clerics inside the Vatican, who had also been participating members of a satanic group, a coven inside the Vatican. And according to their lore, there was a specific time frame during which they had to enthrone Lucifer within the Vatican. It was called the enthronement of the prince in the citadel of the enemy. And I actually spoke with a priest who, 30 years to the day after that dual enthronement ceremony took place, because there was a mass, I believe, in South Carolina, a black mass, and then one in the Vatican. And some of the nastier things, according to the book, were done in South Carolina, and they were correspondingly reenacted to the extent possible in the Vatican over the telephone link. And this priest and Father Malachy, what they did was, on that very day, 30 years later, they both celebrated at the same time what's called a mass of reparation, or a mass of asking for God's forgiveness for this heinously evil act that was perpetrated inside the Vatican, allegedly by people who were supposed to be devoted to God in the first place. So that's, Windswept House kicks off with that. The details are quite lurid, as you probably remember. So I'm not going to belabor them here. Anyone who wants to know can read the book. But the book then hops forward in time to the papacy of John Paul II. And John Paul II, he was known as the world traveling pope, and he thought it was his mission to see and, I guess, preach to as many people as possible. And on a personal level, he was a mystically holy man. I met him in 1995. Malachy Martin made a phone call to Rome, and 2.5 weeks later, I was shaking the Pope's hand. I've got a photograph of it. He was mystical. When he looked at you, he wasn't looking at you, he looked through you. But that does not excuse his errors of church governance. And he knew a lot of these things that we now, I don't like to say taking for granted. It's just we've become numb to the scandals. But he knew about them. And for whatever his reasons were, he chose to do nothing. There was the infamous case a couple of years ago of the former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, right? Not only was he removed as a cardinal, he was laicized by Pope Francis and returned to the lay state, which is about as big a humiliation for a cardinal as is possible. The reason why it happened was because some of his victims from, you know, 20 or so years ago finally came forward with irrefutable evidence saying, here is how I was molested. Here is where it took place. Here are the people who can corroborate it. And, you know, McCarrick had, he could not defend himself against that. There was no defense. It was just, you did it. We've got the evidence. Here's what's going to happen. A lot of people think that he was probably offered up as a sacrificial lamb to say, look, we're doing something. But a lot of people know that it's still very, very prevalent in the Vatican today, unfortunately. And with, you know, with the bishops in Western Europe and the United States. So that ties to Windswept House because it touches on that. But, you know, the big question Windswept House leaves outstanding is, why didn't the Pope do anything? And it comes down to the Pope thought he was going to receive some sort of sign from heaven, so to speak. And he was waiting for that sign. And until he received his sign, whatever that was going to be, his policy was to wait, watch, and just make sure the ship didn't, you know, spring too big of a leak. So, you know, and it also, Windswept House ties into the Keys of This Blood. The Keys of This Blood, if you would think of it, which was published like 4 years earlier, think of it as an instruction manual for the New World Order's ideal pope, molded in their image. And then Windswept House shows the New World Order's efforts to get such a pope enthroned. First, they would have to get the current pope, because John Paul II, although he was not a traditionalist, was still a believer. They had to get him to resign. And Malachy Martin, in that sense, was very prophetic, because it was not John Paul II that they got to resign, but they did compel Pope Benedict XVI to resign. And one thing that I've always found to be oddly prophetic is that when he was first elevated to the papacy in 2005, Pope Benedict famously said, he asked Catholics, pray for me that I do not flee for fear of the wolves. And then 8 years later, a lot of people can make the case, he fled because of the wolves. And we've gotten a pope who has, you know, he has now made it his mission to suppress and eliminate the traditional Latin Mass. He released the letter Traditionis Custodes back in July of this year, which basically did something that was unprecedented. He reversed a still living former pope's very broad permission that he gave for priests to say the Latin Mass, and instituted very harsh restrictions so that in some dioceses around the world, the bishops basically said, finally, we've got a pope with the guts just to say, get rid of this thing. And they're of a similar mind as him, and they've clamped down hard. You know, Francis himself said early in his pontificate, he said, it may very well be that I'm the pope who causes a schism in the Roman Catholic Church. And a lot of this he does, he says off the cuff in airplane interviews. You know, he's a controversial pope. And, you know, I guess a lot of people think that he goes stomping around in heavy army boots where angels would fear to tread. And he is exactly the Pope that Malachi spoke of in chapters 34 and 35 of The Keys of This Blood, and whom the forces aligned against Papa Valeska in Windswept House. He's exactly the kind of Pope they were trying to get installed. He was installed by, are you familiar with the term the St. Gallen Mafia? Okay. There was a former very prestigious Jesuit cardinal, Carlo Martini. He passed away in 2012. And he was opposed theologically to almost everything Pope John Paul II and at the time his right-hand man, Cardinal Ratzinger, were doing and stood for. But he also knew he was at a certain place in the hierarchical totem pole that he had no influence over policy, if we were talking about secular government. So he formed this informal group of like-minded senior prelates, one of which was the former cardinal, I believe the Catholic cardinal in London is the Cardinal of Westminster. Is that it?
I think so.
Okay. One of them was the cardinal from Westminster. I believe his name was Basil Hume. But there was Gottfried Danneels, Cardinal McCarrick, Cardinal Martini, you know, like-minded Cardinal Schönborn from Vienna. They were all like-minded prelates who held that the Catholic Church had to be radically updated in order to keep pace with modern times. And it had to abandon outmoded modes of supernatural belief. Chief among them, the traditional Catholic devotional life, suppression of the traditional Latin Mass as it existed up until about 1965, suppression of traditional devotions like the Holy Rosary, all right, suppression of devotions like the chaplet to Saint Michael and the angels, holy hours, adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. Because, you know, these were modern men, Marty. I mean, who goes into a church, kneels down in front of a little round piece of bread in an ornate holder and worships it as the body, blood, soul, and divinity in reality of Jesus Christ? Come on, we're in the age of iPhones and, you know, sending probes to other planets now. Yeah. That smacks of, you know, medieval fairy tales. And so now you have a Pope who is in line with that line of thinking. You know, it was very telling that early in his pontificate, he was presented with a document that said, you know, Holiness, you know, here is a spiritual bouquet of 100,000 rosaries prayed for the success of your pontificate. He says, I don't care about that. He says, I care about the loneliness of old people and youth unemployment. That's his exact words. And it pretty much set the tone for where he was going. He's a Peronist from Argentina, meaning he'll tell corporate leaders one thing in the morning, and then he'll tell a group of socialist leaders the exact opposite in the afternoon. Because at the exact moment he's saying it, it's what he believes. He has...
So you're not a fan then?
Well, it's not that I'm not a fan. It's just, you know that as a former intelligence officer, I go by factual data.
Yeah.
Right? And if you will indulge me for just a moment, all right, I would just give you some data points that prove, okay, the following are indisputable facts, okay, that contradict what a true vicar of Christ would do. And by the way, almost a year ago, The title Vicar of Christ was retired as a, quote, historical relic, and was no longer to be used. But in 2016, Francis met and praised Italy's most notorious abortionist, known as Emma Bonino. She's an elderly lady now. She's directly responsible for approximately 6 million abortions in Italy. And he praised her as a great Italian woman. What believing Roman Catholic in his mind would refer to a woman who was such an advocate like that? However, she also espouses the legalization of drugs, gay marriage, the whole LGBT agenda, liberalization of pornography laws, mandatory sexual education in the schools for very young children. She identifies with the 1970s feminist slogan, "We are no longer wives, daughters, and mothers. We must destroy the family." Francis has also promoted Father James Martin as a special communications consultant to the Vatican. He's a fellow Jesuit, and he is probably the Catholic Church's most publicly vocal supporter for, let's just say, the sexual topic that will get you thrown off YouTube very quickly if you dare mention it. Marriage between, take it from there. He scandalized people when he made public references to the perverted sexual fetish. Now, I don't know whether or not, are you able to edit these videos? I assume you are. Seriously, only because
I can get banned again. That's fine.
Okay. He made reference to the sexual fetish known as coprophagia. I had to look that one up. And it's people who derive sexual pleasure from eating human feces.
And this is all public. I mean, this is all...
Yes. This is all a matter of the public record. You just Google it.
Scary.
He's publicly dismantled Orthodox holy traditional religious orders, such as the Franciscan Friars of the Immaculate.
It sounds like he's been quite busy.
Well, two more data points. He's consigned the millions of people in the underground Roman Catholic Church in China to the mercy of the Chinese Communist Party.
Okay.
And it's, again, you can go to bitterwinter.org because they follow, it's an Italian organization that follows the persecution of Catholics, Muslims, Uyghurs, and Falun Gong in China.
I don't want to get bogged down in this, but what just from that point alone, what would his motivation be for doing that? What has he come out and explained himself for that one?
Well, he has not explained himself. In fact, when asked, he's pointedly ignored it and left the topic to his spokespeople, who airily dismiss the concerns of believing Catholics. How could you consign millions of people to the Chinese Communist Party? And they just dismiss it. And here's one interesting point is that in Chinese churches now, there are no longer 10 commandments, there are 9 commandments. Because the first commandment is, "I am the Lord thy God, I am a jealous God, and you shall have no other gods before me." And Xi Jinping, the president of China, ordered that struck from the 10 commandments in Chinese churches.
Wow.
Because the Chinese Communist Party is a very jealous God. Now, tying this to Windswept House, you have the enthronement ceremony of Lucifer in the Chapel of St. Peter and Paul, the Pauline Chapel, as it's known. And I may be getting some of the names incorrect here, but when you had the enthronement of the demon, and then in 2019, you had Pope Francis and thrown the Amazonian goddess called Pachamama, the statue, in the Vatican Gardens. And then later it was brought into and put on the altar of the Basilica itself during Mass, a representative representation of that idol. And it's an Amazonian pagan demon goddess. How do you explain that? I mean, you can almost say, you can engage in cognitive dissonance and say, well, yeah, he does all these crazy things that are against the faith, but he's still a good pope. And a lot of people have trouble reconciling A and B. And, you know, we are building towards something. And that's what Maliki said regarding the third secret of Fatima. He says, we are building towards something. And
we'll leave that one to series three, mate. I mean, Fatima, yes, for me is just a large topic, which I'd love to cover in series three.
Well, that's fine.
Talk to us about, sure, what you've mentioned to me previously off record about this sort of our generation would see, is it the approaching scream of an ancient beast or something like that? Talk me through that.
Sure. That phrase Maliki originally used back in the early 1960s, with the onset of the sexual revolution in society, the liberalization in the church, but then the concomitant increase like this, I mean, it's a logarithmic increase in the loss of priests, the loss of nuns, the decline in mass attendance. I mean, literally within the span of 20 years, you went from a church that was arguably the most robust geopolitical force in the world to something that in our day, in many parts of society, is a laughing stock. Mm. Now, if you truly believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God incarnate, how can you believe that he is now, his organization is now a laughing stock within the space of a couple of generations? You know, priests are seen as people to be dangerous to keep, you know, keep your children away from. They're no longer holy men of God. People no longer believe. People no longer go to church. That's what he meant by the approaching scream of the ancient beast, that there would come a point where God would say, okay, you've offended me as far as you can, despite all the warnings I have sent you via my mother's appearances in various places. You know, the Virgin, as you said, Fatima, but there's also Akita, the unapproved apparitions at Garabandal, Spain, the Maliki believed in, which coincidentally began right after the Vatican refused to acknowledge and publish the third secret. But there were all these warnings, and mankind continues to basically ratchet things up against the Lord, as if to say, hey, we have iPhones, we have every technology in the world, you're irrelevant now.
Mm.
And, you know, if God truly does have a plan, then, you know, as Maliki told me once, he says, God will not be mocked forever. He says, there's going to come a time when there will be a reckoning, and it will not be a pleasant one. It is spoken of in the Bible, and it's been spoken of by apparitions. And in the book Windswept House, the character of that represented John Paul II, Papa Valeska, he was awaiting a sign that was going to basically put humanity on notice, that no people could look at, they wouldn't be able to deny what it was, but afterwards they would they would still have their free will, but that there would inevitably some kind of punishment would befall mankind, which is supposed to be greater than the flood of Noah. What that is, your guess is as good as mine. There's many resources out there on approved apparitions that speak of such things. I'm not going to go on record as saying I know what they are. I have read what they may be.
It does feel like recently there is an inevitable tipping point we're all going to be facing. The whole world is in turmoil with this, you know, this COVID virus.
Yeah. I call it the Cerveza virus.
You are going to get me banned, mate. Yeah, it's just... I feel anyway that we are coming to some sort of tipping point, and if people want to call it a reckoning, then so be it. But yeah, let's just get back to Windswept House, in a sense that why do you think the book was, as many of his books were, why was it this one sort of singled out to be one of his most controversial? Was it because he was presuming that this black mass did happen in the Vatican? What in your own words, why do you think this was probably one of his most controversial books?
Well, that black mass in the Vatican was certainly one of the most controversial parts of the book. I mean, if you want to go just by sheer shock value, you could almost consider the rest of the story interesting but mundane in relation to, you know, a black mass happening in the Vatican, you know, and people question whether or not it's just a literary device for loss of faith among the senior clergy of the Catholic Church. However, for another priest who was in his mid-30s at the time, along with Malachy, on the 30th anniversary, as I mentioned before, to say those masses of reparation or to repair the evil that was done, that priest, I spoke to him, and he said, I am not saying I have direct knowledge of such a black mass. He said, what I am saying is that it would be a grievous sin for Malachy Martin to make that up, put it into a book, and then have me celebrate at the same time, 30 years later, a formal, solemn mass of reparation for that happening, if it was merely a literary device. He said, so I know that Malachy Martin firmly believed such an event took place. The way that he found out about it was one of the participants was on his deathbed sometime in, I believe it was either the late 60s or the 1970s, and he confessed to being a participant in the Black Mass. And the priest he told it to said, I have to withhold absolution from you unless you give me permission to have what you just told me told to the Holy Father. And the person who was dying, you know the old phrase, there are no atheists in a foxhole?
Yeah.
Well, he was staring over the edge into eternity and didn't like what he saw, so he said, yes, I do repent. You may tell the Holy Father everything that I've told you.
Mm.
And that person was part of the U.S. end of it in South Carolina. And he died with the sacraments of the church with a last-minute reconciliation. But that's, you know, that's how Malachy Martin, you know, he found out about that through his Vatican sources. He was very well connected.
And people can still, the book's still online to buy and stuff?
You can purchase it on Amazon in, I believe, the paperback format that I've got right over there. Or I believe it's still available on Google Play. It's also available on Amazon Kindle. And there are several places where people have put a scanned PDF just out there online for free. Because there have been times when, for reasons unknown, Amazon and Google and the publisher have just stopped making the book available. And you know, take from that what you will.
Yeah, I've always said it'll make a great live action series, Windswept House. It's a fantastic story.
Oh, I completely agree with you, because, you know, just the reality of it and, you know, what we're facing now, it would be utterly compelling. Utterly compelling.
Do you ever wonder fitting Maliki Martin into this current time? Do you ever think about how, one, he would have responded to the social media surge? Because he was very much ahead of his time back in the 70s and 80s with the use of radio and TV appearances. And he did use especially the radio, especially the Art Bell show, to really broadcast his message. How do you think, I mean, would he have used the new generation, sort of the new generation sort of technical kind of mindset of the social media push, or would he have been quite standoffish with it? And secondly, how do you think he would have responded to the current situation now with regards to the church, state of the Catholic Church, and also with the way the world is going with regards to this let's call it a pandemic?
Well, to answer your first question, I believe he would have embraced any modern means of communication. He was that kind of, he was a Jesuit. And Jesuits were always, you know, very strong in their scientific learning and inquisitiveness. So that would, to embrace the technologies of the internet, you know, he did in the seminal years of the internet back in the mid-1990s. He actually had his own website, and he would occasionally write little blurbs that he would put up on his website. But that's been gone for years. So, but I believe he would have embraced it totally. Now, we are both under the assumption that by now he'd be approaching 100 years old. So just how physically able he would be able to do. But I do believe he still would have given interviews to people like Bernard Jensen. Up at Triumph Communications.
Yeah.
The problem is, a lot of people, what they know of Maliki, they get through the Art Bell recordings. And Maliki was very, very indulgent to the people that the call screener let through. Because if someone was let through and they said, "Maliki, what do you think about the epidemic of werewolves and vampires in France?" I mean, the poor man had to answer that question.
Yeah, there was no screening.
Whereas with Bernard Jansen of Triumph Communications up in Canada, they were all very orthodox Roman Catholic interviews. And his final one, called The Tempter's Hour, sums up everything he ever said.
So, yeah, that's a good reminder. And also for any audiences who are listening or watching, Bernard Jansen's work is, with Maliki Martin, is extremely, it's very, very good. And he kindly licensed some of his audio for my documentary as well. So Bernard's a good guy. It's a good source of information if you want to learn more about Maliki's teachings.
And I also believe that if he were alive today, he would be using social media, but especially communications through his writing.
I thought you were going to say TikTok then. Especially,
no, I could not. For him, TikTok would be sitting at his desk and waving at someone.
What I meant by that question was, if you were to bring it's the Maliki Martin that you knew before he died, you know, into this sort of current period of our lives, you know, I'm sure there is even now a lot of lost souls out there who are looking for answers and they can't find it. And would have felt like, as usual, he would have filled that sort of, would he have plugged that sort of hole for many?
Without a doubt. He was fearless in that respect, and he viewed it as his tiny little apostolate run from this tiny little cubbyhole within the Lovanos apartment. It was separate, distinct. It was his little cubbyhole. But from there, he ran a worldwide apostolate to bring the message of the gospel as seen by the Catholic Church, the authentic gospel, to as many people as possible, through whatever communications media were available, through his books, through going to see them at 3 a.m. in the morning to baptize a dying baby in a New York hospital. You know, when I get a call from Maliki at 2 a.m. saying, you know, are you available to drive me somewhere? You know, the answer was yes, but that's the kind of man he was. He was selfless.
Yeah.
He was selfless. I knew the man for the last 10 years of his life. And, you know, the Lord and the Blessed Virgin, you know, came before everything, because, you know, in everything he said, he says, the mother of Christ always points to Christ. And he was always very careful to make that distinction, because a lot of people have problems with that. And he would point to that scene in the gospel, the wedding at Cana, the only recorded words of the Virgin Mary. And those words are, when the servants went to her and said, we're running out of wine, what do we do? And all she did was, the Virgin Mary pointed at her son, Jesus, and said, do whatever he tells you to do. And Maliki believed that carried down to the current day, which is why he dedicated his books to the Immaculate Heart of the Virgin. But if he was alive today, he would be using, you know, whatever he was physically capable of utilizing to get the message out. And, you know, it would, consequences be damned.
He was quite vocal about the Antichrist as well, wasn't he? He was quite, especially on the Art Bell show, about the Antichrist, you know, they would appear and we would recognize who it would be, but it would be a fake, you know, it would be, they would present themselves as this, you know, this prophet and this sort of Messiah, but in fact it was the Antichrist. And it was quite, you know, to listen to that, it was incredible to listen to, but also very, I was pretty scared listening to that on the Art Bell show when it came out.
Well, I remember he told me once, he asked me to accompany him to a religious goods store down in South Manhattan. And we were on the Lexington line of the subway in Manhattan. And we got into the topic of the Antichrist. And he said, oh, he is alive today. And which kind of struck me. And I said, wait a minute. If he doesn't make his appearance, I said, when do you think that'll be? He says, well, I'll be playing a harp by the time that comes around. He says, you may very well be playing a harp by the time he reveals himself. He says, but your children and your children's children will see him. He called him the man of perdition. And I said, wait a minute. If he's alive today and he was born circa 1961, 62, if he doesn't reveal himself until, say, the year 2050, he's going to be almost 100 years old. And that's when Maliki corrected me and said, no, you're overlooking one thing. His father is Lucifer. And he said, because of that preternatural aspect to his being, he will appear ageless. So it will be no problem for him to maintain the visual appearance of a 35 to 40 year old man for many, many years, decades. And he said, yes. He says, the world will be in such a state that they will be looking to anyone who can promise them answers. It'll just be at one condition. You renounce the Jesus Christ of the New Testament. Do that, all the disease will be taken away. Poverty, hunger, homelessness, every ill plaguing every society in the world, I will make disappear like that, if you will worship me. And that's going to be, Maliki told me that would be a very compelling proposition for a lot of people.
Especially when people have gotten...
Especially when the church becomes so discredited.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Mate. Absolutely. Yeah, people are getting desperate, and they'll do anything when they're in a desperate state. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to leave on sort of too much doom and gloom, but...
Wherever you want to take this.
Yeah, no, we'll finish off there, but is there anything, you know, anything that Maliki... You know, you mentioned the lovely moment there going grocery shopping, but is there anything that he said to you that's really stuck with you, which you could tell the audience now, which would give them a little bit of hope?
Yes. That no matter how bad things seem to become, the Lord is always in control. And as long as you maintain your faith, no matter how many people laugh at you, no matter how many people dismiss you for being an idiot or ignore you, or, you know, it's in the Gospel of John. People will hate you and despise you and throw you out of the marketplace, the temples, and establishments, all because you acknowledge my name. And Malachi would say, despite all of that, hold fast to the tenets of the faith. He said, because during the Arian heresy of the early centuries of the church, he says, we are in a worse crisis now, but we each individually know what we must do to save our immortal souls. You have the information at your fingertips. Be an adult, believe, and act upon it. And it's ultimately a message of hope, because, you know, right now people see what's going on in the world, but they don't realize what they're seeing are tactical battles when the war was won on a windswept execution hill outside Jerusalem called Golgotha 2,000 years ago. It was won. Christ defeated the forces of evil and reopened mankind to a relationship with the Father, which had been sealed. And so the war has been won. We just have to keep fighting. We fight until we pass away. And as it says in the New Testament, you know, I have fought the good fight. I have run the good race. Laid up for me is the crown of glory. And ultimately, stick to the faith. Do not deviate whatever anyone promises. If it deviates from it, reject it out of hand. And just be steadfast. Be a rock. Be a rock. Don't deviate from the faith, no matter what. Because the temptation is great. The temptation is at times overwhelming. I've experienced it. You know, my confessor, my pastor knows that. It's a great temptation. But I have to hold on. Because if I don't hold on, then it's nothing. So it's ultimately a message of hope. That if you persevere, everything will be fine. Because what's really important is your immortal soul. You know, my father passed away a year and a half ago in the hospital. And for as painful as that was for me to see him die right in front of me, all right, I also believe that his soul is in paradise. And some people might say, well, you're presuming on God's mercy. I had, you know, a traditional Gregorian Latin masses said for the repose of his soul. But I believe. And as long as you believe and you hold on to your belief like a pit bull dog holding on to a bone, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. The rest is all noise and chatter.
Beautiful, Mike. Beautiful close. Well, thanks again for your time, Robert, and it's always a joy to catch up with you. Hopefully next time I speak to you, I'll have an eye patch on the other eye. But
oh, man.
I know, mate. But no, that's absolute joy. Yeah, it's absolute joy. And hope. It's a nice way to finish. A little bit of hope, a sprinkle of hope. And
and by the way, I don't mean to correct you. It's a lot of hope.
A lot of hope, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
As long as you hold on to the faith, and it will exist, and people will still be able to find it, no matter how many priests are canceled, no matter how many things are suppressed, if they look for it hard enough, they will find the sacraments, they will find the Mass. And if they can't find any of them, they always have the Rosary, which is the meditation on the life, passion, and resurrection of the Lord. So it's ultimately hopeful. It's good. It's good. You know, here's one final quote I'll leave you from Malachi, right? You know, at the time, he didn't call me Robert or Rob. He called me Bob. And he said, Bob, there will come a time many years from now what people will say of the Catholics that lived through this period of history, they will say we were blessed and honored to be able to do that. And that's what he firmly believed. That's what he firmly believed. So, one funny thing is that Mel Gibson really stirred up a hornet's nest when he put forth that little 4-minute video, because,
A podcast in itself.
Yes, when he starts quoting Pope Pius V and Quo Primum and taking on Francis, that's a whole other podcast for itself. But confirmation of the faith comes from the most unlikely sources.
Would you class yourself as a traditional?
Ultimately good.
But if anyone who you class yourself as a traditional Catholic, is that right?
Well, I call myself a Roman Catholic.
A Roman Catholic.
But I follow the traditional beliefs, devotional practices of the Catholic Church as they existed and were commonly practiced up until approximately 1962.
So for any audiences who are listening or watching that wants to maybe go back to that literature or who are sort of inquisitive about that kind of area, where do you go for your sources of information and teachings?
I would start with listening, just so they get to establish a kind of a narrative framework for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Literally, I would go back again to The Tempter's Hour by Malachy Martin and Bernard Jensen. Yeah. Listen to that, because in there, he tells you, read this, do this,
right,
practice this, look for this, and you'll be okay. I believe I sent you a link to a book. I think it's called Our Catholic Faith.
Okay.
And it's an old book that was published up until about 1965 that has, a much easier to read and understand version of the catechism.
Right.
People could go to that book.
Yeah, I'll leave a link in the description. Yeah, yeah, that's great.
Yes, or even you've heard of the Baltimore Catechism.
Yeah. Okay?
The Baltimore Catechism, as it was up until 1965, that would be perfectly fine. It's not difficult. We have the internet. It can be used for good and evil. But in this case, it would definitely be used for good.
Great, mate. Right, so, I'll leave you there.
Very good.
Yeah. Stay safe. Keep your head down. Speak soon.
You too. All right. Take care, buddy.
See you, mate. Bye-bye.
Malachy, what is the future of all of this? We're coming up on the end of the millennium, and everybody is acting strange, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
There is a funny. We're in a trance. We all know in our bones, no matter how smug we may appear to be, we all know we're in transition. And since we've been talking about the Roman Catholic Church, let me say what I think. At the present moment, this Roman Catholic Church, of which I'm a member and a practicing priest, I say Mass every day, and I hear babies, I hear confessions, and I baptize babies, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm a believer. I'm really Michael Fuddy-Duddy, conservative believer, believe me.
Maybe that's not so bad in light of everything that I've seen here.
But in the light of all that, hear what I say. This organization, I'm talking about the visible organization, from the Pope down to the local parish priest, diocese. This is a Potemkin village. It's a facade.
Okay.
There is no longer any evangelization taking place.
No.
There is no longer any vibrancy. Life has gone out of the system.
As well as hope.
As well as hope. The system is shot, but it's a Potemkin village, still as glorious panoplies. And if the Pope comes to this country, he can expect a crowd of 500,000. 750,000, and they come out to see him and to venerate him and to sort of say God bless our Pope and to stand in the rain at his Mass as they did in Yonkers. 250,000 of them stood.
I know there was some really weird energy, not weird, but I mean good energy.
Sure.
In 93 when he was here in Denver.
I know, tremendous. But the organization as such is dead. It is dead.
So we're going to see some big changes.
Well, you're going to see a marginalization. The Roman Catholic Church is going to be marginalized politically and culturally.
And
reduced quantitatively finally and qualitatively bettered, but within a short time there's going to be a real shortage of priests and a real shortage of nuns. There are going to be very few Catholic colleges.
Okay, Malachy, that's it. I'm sorry. That should be the last word. We're out of here tonight. This is it.